Good evening. This is your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Thursday night, May 7th, 2020. Ahead tonight, we continue our conversations with the instructors of a pandemic-centric forum. The University of Arkansas's Honors College will start next week. My conversation with Jenny Popp, Associate Dean of the Honors College and Professor of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness, in about 10 minutes. Tomorrow on Science Friday, Black, Latino, and Native American communities have been hit the hardest by coronavirus in the U.S. A conversation about the deep-rooted reasons why some communities have drastically higher infection rates. Science Friday, tomorrow, beginning at 1 on 91.3 KUAF. For the first time in 50 days, Governor Asa Hutchinson hosted his daily press briefing from a city other than Little Rock today. From Texarkana, the governor discussed an increase in both testing and confirmed cases and other matters this afternoon. The governor says there were 97 new positive cases of COVID-19 reported since his midday briefing Wednesday. That's a larger increase than previous 24-hour periods this week. But he says there was more testing, too. Yesterday, the state had one of its highest one-day testing totals, 2,174. He says the increase of both cases and tests is not a surprise.
What that tells me is that my prediction is coming true, that while we have a downward trend, we're going to have occasions that it goes up a little bit, whether it is in our prison environment or whether it is some other area. And that doesn't mean we're on the wrong path, but you're going to have a jagged pattern as you go on the decline.
The governor says the state is giving new guidance to the state's three casinos toward a gradual resumption of activity there. The governor says representatives of the casino industry and the state have worked together to develop a path forward.
They will be opening on May 18th at one-third capacity. One-third capacity with stringent social distancing requirements in place. And they're continuing to work with Dr. Smith. He'll be releasing the guidance late today or tomorrow to further instruct how this opening should take place.
The governor says there will be strict monitoring of the casinos to make sure those guidelines are followed. Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, says he spoke yesterday with Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the CDC, about Arkansas's efforts to slow the spread of the virus. Dr. Smith says Dr. Redfield complimented Arkansas on an ability to attack the virus, but also keep some business transactions happening.
I was very pleased with that input, especially since to hear some people talk, it seems like they think you have to choose between saving lives or saving the economy. And I want to say that really is a false choice, because here in Arkansas, we're doing both. It's not true that you can just let the COVID-19 go out of control and that your economy is going to recover. It won't. Who wants to come to a state where you've got an out-of-control epidemic? Who wants to start a business in a place where you have an out-of-control epidemic?
As of mid-afternoon today, there are now 3,665 cumulative cases of COVID-19 diagnosed in Arkansas, with 88 deaths connected to the virus. Dr. Smith says there are 710 cases of the virus considered active in the state, with 70 people currently hospitalized because of coronavirus. This is Ozarks at Large. This week, the Walton Family Foundation announced a new initiative to support farmers and access to locally grown food. To learn more about Northwest Arkansas food systems, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke via Zoom with Rebecca Hazelwood, Senior Program Officer at Walton Family Foundation. She says the initiative has been in the works for some time.
We've actually been working on the program for several years. We have done a a study to assess the needs for the program, and we were actually going to announce the program that the week the pandemic hit, and so we actually put it on pause and waited for a time where it was a little bit, there was some opportunity to present the program.
So it's something you've been looking into because you saw the importance, but how has the pandemic kind of highlighted that importance of local farmers and local food?
It's obviously something that's on everybody's mind with the shortages that's all around, but it didn't necessarily heighten the need for us in any way more than what it already was. It's something that we've been caring about for several years now, and we've been working on for a while. I will say that what the pandemic has done is it's created an opportunity for some of our partners to pivot their work and test out some new things that they probably hadn't been thinking about otherwise.
So the new initiative is called Northwest Arkansas Food Systems. What are some of the goals of the program?
The vision for the program is to serve as a national model for food grown locally, to help to support our local economy, and to provide healthy food access for all. We're really looking to support small-scale farmers and improve their access to wholesale fresh produce markets.
And so here locally, you're working with three regional nonprofits. How are you supporting them? Is it just by finance or just by or connections as well?
I would say both. We're certainly providing them with grant funding to start new programs. The Northwest Arkansas Land Trust just launched a FarmLink program that's going to improve access to farmland by connecting landowners with experienced farmers interested in purchasing land. And we're working with the Center for Arkansas Farm and Food at the University of Arkansas on an apprenticeship program that matches novice farmers with established farms where they can work alongside some seasoned farmers. Later, we hope to be opening a new farmer program at the university. And we're working with a group called the Food Conservancy, who was originally in Kansas City, and they've now opened operation here in Northwest Arkansas with a food hub that's going to aggregate and distribute locally grown produce to meet the demand of wholesale markets here.
Can you tell me more about the program at the university that you hope to start?
The program right now is an apprenticeship program, and the program that will be launching in the coming months will be a farming program for new farmers. It'll be field and class-based, so very heavily based on hands-on in the field, getting your hands dirty, learning the work. So anyone who's never had any experience would be able to enter the program there.
And the Food Conservancy, they're already helping get that food out right now, correct?
Correct. It's looking very different than what they had originally planned with restaurants and schools closing, but they have created a box program that community members for $20 a week can get a box of locally grown produce. I've gotten it for the last 3 weeks and it's beautiful.
And if I'm a farmer who wants to be involved in any way, shape or form in a couple, because there's lots of different options here, what is the best way for them to do that? Is there one main contact that they should talk to first at the foundation and then kind of sort through, or how does that work?
They should go directly to the Food Conservancy. They're doing all the work on this program and they're a great group. They've made connection with 10 to 20 farmers here locally already, and you can go to their website and check it out. I think this is a really exciting program for the foundation. I think that the impact for our community is really great, and we're excited to help grow the local economy and support healthy food access for all and improve the quality of life in a new way.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Rebecca Hazelwood is Senior Program Officer at the Walton Family Foundation. She spoke via Zoom with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda earlier this week. More information about the initiative can be found at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. This is Ozarks at Large. It's hard to identify a segment of society not altered because of the COVID-19 outbreak. A University of Arkansas Honors College two-week forum beginning next week will cover the pandemic from many different angles. And we continue our series of conversations with some of the instructors who will lead sessions of the forum with Jenny Pop, Associate Dean of the Honors College and professor of agricultural economics and agribusiness at the U of A. She'll co-lead a class about the economic impact of the lockdown on May 20th. Earlier this week, we called her at home. She says preparing for this class is different than getting ready for regular courses.
First of all, this is rapid fire information that's coming at us now. When I check my statistics online, they change from Monday to Friday. So it means staying on top of the material on a daily basis. Because this is an intercession course, we also have a very short period of time to try to squeeze in a lot of information to students. So it definitely makes preparations very different.
Yeah, so that will give it an incredibly contemporary feel. I mean, if you're talking about GDP numbers and things like that, students will know that, gosh, by the time this two-week intercession class is over, those numbers that you're talking about on your day could be altered.
They will be altered.
They will
for
be
sure.
Altered, yeah. So what do we know, what can we know at this point about things like the labor force and GDP moving forward?
Well, what we can know is based on what we've already seen. And what we have seen already is decreases. And unfortunately, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but that's what we're seeing in the economy right now. In the last quarter, GDP fell 4.8%. And 4.8% in terms of GDP is a lot, especially when you compare it to the fact that last year we were up 2%. So that's a big change. The forecasts moving forward are even worse. It's because that first quarter GDP numbers, January, the economy, and lots of February, we were still chugging along really well. So it didn't, only a very small portion of that time frame had any negative impacts associated with the coronavirus. Since our next reports will be based on full coronavirus times, we can expect a much greater response. Something that economists look to in order to get information are surveys. We're huge on surveying, and a lot of consumer surveys ask the consumers what they intend to do in the future. And by all indications, most surveys are showing that consumers are really holding back their money. The little bit of money that they may have if they're still employed, they're really shifting their spending patterns. They're focusing in on necessities and not really using much other discretionary spending beyond that. In terms of jobs, again, the information isn't good. That 4.8 is an important number right now. 4.8 unemployment across the nation. Across the state of Arkansas. And that's up above, I think, 3.5%. So unemployment is growing in the state at the moment. It's growing nationally. And as a response, we're seeing real decreases in the amount of expenditures in what we call durable goods, things like cars and furniture. Non-durable goods are things like food and clothing. Food expenditures we know have been way up, but that's at the expense of expenditures on clothing. Since we're all working at home, and people aren't finding really good reasons to go out and spend on clothing. Recreation services are down. Unfortunately, the loss in tourism and recreation jobs has been horrendous across the country. And unfortunately, what the projections show is that we're not going to see that turnaround anytime soon, even with states opening.
This reminds me of something like a chessboard where each move can affect what are the next five or six moves. Is that sort of how we're looking at, like, what happens now might affect something a little bit later, and that might have other ripple effects?
That's right. In economics, we have these things we call the multiplier effect, which can be a domino effect. An effect in one industry can have an impact in another and another. For example, my primary focus is agriculture. And in agriculture, we try to measure what we call direct impacts of agriculture. And so that's the jobs and economic activity that happens in the ag sector. But the ag sector is supported by other industries that help feed the animals, help fertilize the crops. And so anything that agriculture needs causes an impact in those supply sectors. Now, everybody in both the agriculture sector and the supply sectors have incomes that come from those activities, and they spend it on other things. So an example I like to use in my class is the fact that we have rice farming in eastern Arkansas allows us to have bowling alleys in northwest Arkansas because of the trickle-down effect of those spending effects. So when we see one thing happen in one sector, an important spending sector such as durable goods and non-durable goods, we will see impacts ripple through the economy moving forward.
Farming is never about certainty. Floods, drought, tornadoes, things like that can alter pests. Is the pandemic just something that adds on to the uncertainty of agriculture?
Absolutely. When we look at the agriculture sector, we typically look at the crop sector and the animal sector separately because they face different kind of constraints. The crop sector is definitely more directly impacted by weather. The animal sector will be indirectly impacted in terms of feed availability, but they face different things. Things that are affecting the crop sector, particularly the specialty crop sector, are very wet seasons to begin. A lot of the rain makes planting difficult, but when the weather is warm, like it has been unseasonably warm, at least in our part of the country, we see that those planting periods are moved up quicker. You couple that with the need for migrant workers that are much more difficult to get this year because the visa restrictions have reduced the number of migrant workers that can legally come into the states to help with the planting and harvesting activities. So those are the types of constraints that a lot of the crop and specialty crop production are facing right now. All over the news, we've seen lots about the processing sector of the meat side. There have been closures or temporary closures or reduced activity in a lot of the meat processing plants. A lot of the news I've seen has focused in on the impact of illness related to coronavirus, but that's not the only reason. The first drop of workers showing up at these plants really happened when the schools closed because a lot of folks have children and had no child care for their children, so they couldn't make it into the job. So the combination of the school closings and the illness has reduced the number of available workers in these plants. And when we talk about that domino effect, if the plants aren't working to capacity, that means less animals can move through these plants, which backs things up not only at the plant, but at the farm, and will ultimately lead to a reduction of the amount of food available in the supermarkets in the future.
There seem to be these sort of contrasting concerns looking forward. There's worry about shortages, but then there's also concern about surplus, everything from potatoes in Belgium to dairy farmers having to pour milk out. How do those relate to each other, or do they?
They do, and it seems contradictory that we'll see a shortage in the supermarket, yet know that there has been excess food around the world, and that has to do with a lot of our supply chain markets. I'm not going to talk too much about that today because that will be covered in another section led by Dean Matt Waller, who is going to be speaking as part of our pandemic class. But part of the problem with the distribution has to do with packaging, for example. Think about the milk industry, as you mentioned. A lot of milk is served in schools and other cafeterias, and they package them in those half-pint containers. Once they're packaged that way, they really can't take them back to the milk plant, repackage them in gallons to move them over to the supermarket. So when the supply chains and the packaging chains are disrupted, we'll see those disruptions in the supermarket. A lot of products are reliant on export markets, and when demand falls around the world, certain areas of the world are going to see stockpiles of certain crops and other food products because nobody's demanding them elsewhere.
With this being such an unprecedented event, we don't know if we're in the beginning, the middle, we certainly don't think we're at the end, of course, is there a way for agricultural interests, be they small, medium, or big, to move forward with any confidence?
We do the best we do in agriculture every year. As you mentioned early on, there is innate risk in agriculture, but I'm really impressed with at least locally, what we're seeing that that farmers are doing. They're agile. Their markets, their local markets, perhaps a farmer's market or a restaurant has closed down. So they're turning to alternative markets. What can they do in order to get their product out? They're moving to sell online. They're working with wholesalers. A new group in the area, the Food Conservancy, is helping to move a lot of excess produce that would have been sold at the farmers markets into the communities in other ways. They are looking to shore up their supply chains and diversify a little more. They're looking at changing their workforce. If we can't have the migrant laborers come in, how can we take some of the folks that may have been displaced in the tourism and recreation areas and give them some jobs, at least temporarily, in agriculture? So there's always some sort of innovative thinking going on with farmers. If farmers weren't innovative, they wouldn't succeed in the first place.
Maybe we don't know specifics yet, but is it fair to assume that this will have some lasting effects, some lasting changes in some way on agriculture and business?
We don't know yet, but I would suspect it would. I think all of the ways of business moving forward, whether we're talking about agriculture or other industries, is going to change. We're going to really need to think about how our supply chain operates. We're really going to need to think about that balance between producing things for local consumption as well as for export, either out of our region or out of our nation. We're going to have to think about what those processing plants are, in not just for basic meat production, but in terms of packaging for different types of markets, and how quickly they can change to shift their product to get to different places. So agriculture as we know it, I believe, has changed. There's no doubt about it, just like most other industries will change moving forward. And it's going to take a collective thought process with the different crops and animal industry leaders to figure out the best way moving forward for our nation.
Jenny Popp is Associate Dean of the Honors College at the University of Arkansas. She's also a professor of agricultural economics and agribusiness at the U of A. And on May 20th, she'll co-lead a session of the Honors College Forum about the pandemic. Dee Fong, Assistant Professor of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness, will also be part of that session. She'll discuss food access and food deserts. The Pandemic Forum will take place May 11th through the 22nd. The Honors College will provide free public access to the forum by posting a recording of each class online. You can go to honorscollege.uark.edu/pandemic.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. When caring for a seriously ill loved one, the journey shouldn't be taken alone. Circle of Life Hospice can help. Services are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance. No one is turned away based on an inability to pay. 750-6632 or nwacircleoflife.com for more.
We know things are different for you right now, your schedule, your children's schedules, your routines, and we know that hearing the stories, interviews, and information about where you live featured on our show every day at noon and 7 isn't always easy or even possible. So we've made our podcast available to you for free through services like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and other places where podcasts are hosted. You can also tell your smart speaker to play Ozarks at Large. And we also have daily highlights that can be delivered right to your email inbox. We have a free Ozarks at Large daily newsletter, complete with links to the stories about health, the economy, arts, music, and more that we present every day right here. You can subscribe to that daily newsletter right now at KUAF.com/newsletter. This is Ozarks at Large. There are environmentally concerned organizations in the region paying attention to federal regulatory rules and changes during the pandemic. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich stopped by the Illinois River Watershed Partnership in Cave Springs to check in on that group.
Nicole Hardiman, director of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership, had agreed to meet up on the nonprofit's 30-acre sanctuary across from headquarters until a thunderstorm struck. Instead, she settled into the conference room to talk first about her mission.
Our mission is to improve the integrity of the Illinois River through public education, community outreach, and implementation of conservation and restoration projects. So it is our goal to take our stakeholders, landowners, members of the public, from uneducated and aware to implementation and action.
And second, how is her 15-year-old nonprofit faring during a global pandemic?
Spring and fall are our busiest times of year, and we do have a number of public-facing programs. We have our field tours and workshops for landowners and stakeholders. We do one-on-one consultations with folks that live in the watershed. And in the era of COVID-19, all of that's kind of been put on hold.
This season, the organization's offering virtual workshops until they decide to safely reopen to the public.
6 best management practices that we advocate for. So commercial low impact development, what a business owner can do to mitigate stormwater impact, all the way to rotational grazing practices for our farmers.
Illinois River Watershed Partnership's Online Learning Center also features a youth education page for teachers and parents suitable for children who are distance learning.
So you can find educational YouTube videos that really focus on water quality, the natural world, human impact to water quality in the natural world. So there will be a learning module, but then we also have activities to kind of substantiate the concepts in the videos. We have also sent out to some of our local teachers that we regularly partner with a complete learning module with the hope that they'll incorporate that into their curriculum for this springtime learning session at home.
Hardiman says the public is welcome to visit the watershed sanctuary if they practice social distancing.
And it really embodies some of those concepts that we're trying to teach. So the importance of forests and native ecosystems for water quality. We have the stream and cave spring there that contains threatened and endangered species. So the importance of clean water to protect those species, not only on our property, but throughout the entire watershed.
During the pandemic, Hardiman says she and staff have been monitoring recent sweeping deregulation of historic environmental laws by the Trump administration. One is the 50-year-old National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA for short, passed in 1970. It provides transparency as well as broad public input on the impact to air, water, land, and wildlife by proposed mining, drilling, and logging permits on public lands, as well as construction of new dams, highways, utility right-of-ways, and pipelines. Opponents characterize it as the largest rollback in history of federal protection of the environment. The Trump administration is expected to finalize the change this summer.
The public needs to be able to provide guidance. There are experts out there that haven't been heard from in some of these permitting processes, and that is an important step in the law. EPA is a complicated place, and it can be a bureaucracy, and can it be more efficient as the Trump administration wants it to be? Probably, yes. But we do want to make sure that the law, as intended, fulfills its purpose in protecting waters and the air in the United States.
Another concern, Hardiman says, is proposed changes by the Trump administration to the Federal Clean Water Rule. Established during the Obama administration in 2015, the Clean Water Rule enabled EPA, as well as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, to clarify protective water resource management under the provision of the Clean Water Act of 1972.
Intermittent streams are no longer considered regulated water bodies, some wetlands, and in particular, groundwater. So in Northwest Arkansas and across all of North Arkansas, you can think of watersheds as almost three-dimensional systems. They're not just two-dimensional length and width of a stream or a creek. We have lots of caves, lots of underground water sources. And in Northwest Arkansas, we have the headwaters of most of our watersheds are located in Northwest Arkansas. So many of those streams that don't regularly have water in them will no longer be considered regulated water bodies.
And the Ozarks are numerous seasonal ephemeral tributaries, categorized as losing streams, where fresh water trickles through gravel or bedrock, recharging water tables and aquifers, water which can reemerge in certain karst terrain as springs. Such waterways no longer warrant federal protection from industrial or agricultural pollution. The final Clean Water Rule, redefining the waters of the United States under the Clean Water Act, was published the day before Earth Day, April 21st. On May 5th, attorneys general from 17 states, not including Arkansas, filed a complaint for declaratory and injunctive relief in a U.S. district court in California, challenging the rule. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And still to come on our show, journalism students at the University of Arkansas spent the now completed spring semester collecting stories of people who live in our area without permanent shelter. We'll hear from some of those students in about 10 minutes on today's Ozarks at Large.
I'm Paul Gatling, and this is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. On the program today, we'll hear from Eric Pinalto. He's the president of Mercy Hospital Northwest Arkansas in Rogers. He dropped by our Springdale studio recently and said as healthcare begins a return to more normal routines, the lessons learned during the COVID-19 pandemic will last a lifetime. That's a little later in the program. First, though, Tyson Foods has resumed limited production today at its largest U.S. pork plant in Waterloo, Iowa. That comes 1 week after President Donald Trump ordered companies to keep meat processing plants open to protect the supply chain. The Waterloo facility was closed April 22nd because of a coronavirus outbreak among workers. In a statement earlier this week, Tyson Foods said the reopening followed a tour of the plant by local health and law enforcement officials, labor union and other business leaders, and a joint company and community leader review of the company's protocol to safely resume operations. The Waterloo plant has the ability to process 19,500 hogs per day. That accounts for 3.9% of the U.S. pork processing capacity, according to the National Pork Board. We are following that story with our reporting online, and you can too. Just go to nwabusinessjournal.com. After the break, a conversation with Mercy Hospital President Eric Pinalto. So stick around for this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security. Member FDIC. Equal Housing Lender.
Eric Pinalto says as healthcare returns to more normal routines, the lessons learned during the COVID-19 pandemic will last a lifetime. Pinalto, who is president of Mercy Health Northwest Arkansas in Rogers, said from community messaging to adaptable workforces to managing inventory, his health system and others will run their businesses differently. Pinalto was a guest with Roby Brock on a recent episode of Talk Business and Politics, discussing how the healthcare system has coped with COVID-19.
Well, Eric, as a healthcare leader, what have the past 6 weeks been like for you in terms of how you and your hospital have coped with COVID-19?
Yeah, you know, Roby, that's a great question. The last 6 or 7 weeks have been, you know, 7 days a week, 15, 20-hour days, a lot of time on the phone, a lot of times with our team, did a lot of planning, pretty intense work. But, you know, I would also say I admire and just marvel at our physician leaders, our nurse leaders, how their teams have responded to this crisis and the amount of work they're doing. is something that we should all be proud of. It's incredible work, and they're exceptional people, and just great for the community. It's been incredible.
Well, we've obviously had a relaxing of some of the guidelines around elective surgeries from the health department. Some things are going to return a little bit more to normal in a hospital setting and some of the medical clinics and physician clinics. Tell me what's right around the corner. What are you working on in terms of how it relates to elective surgeries and some of the other procedures that might be allowed?
Sure. We are ready to start taking care of patients for needed services. Something I like to remind people is we take care of infectious disease every day. That's a 7 day a week, 365 day a year. We have infectious disease in our hospitals, in our facilities. We're used to taking care of infectious disease. So we're ready. We're prepared all of the time to take care of our people who need health care safely and effectively. The governor did lift restrictions this week for elective procedures, imaging, a lot of our normal services, but we'll still go about that slow, both from a safety perspective. This is highly infectious, and we want to be sure that people feel comfortable in our facilities, but also, you know, as you've seen on the national news, protective equipment has been in short supply. Testing continues, and testing kits has continued to be in short supply. So we want to be mindful as we start this back up that we have enough supplies on hand to take care of the public and to protect our folks. So it's a nice balance right now. We'll remain vigilant. We'll remain ready if in the event that we do see a surge in this community. But we have a lot of folks that really need to start getting their care again, and we don't need to defer or delay that any longer.
Well, there's been a lot of emphasis on safety over the last few weeks, on protocol for not coming to the hospital at all unless absolutely necessary. More people have been pushed to online services. They've been encouraged to go other places or to deal with their health issues in other ways. Speak to this issue of safety for people who are going to have the opportunity to return to the hospitals now. Alleviate that fear of patient safety for me.
Sure. You know, I will tell you the primary reason that we've asked folks to stay home and not be in our facilities and we put those restrictions in place is that this particular infection, a lot of people could get it and could get it rapidly. What that causes us to do as healthcare workers to protect our patients and to protect our staff and teams, our doctors, our nurses, and others, we have to use a lot of protective equipment in that instance. And so there was a lot in the beginning we didn't know about this virus. So there was a potential for us to overuse protective equipment, overuse our supplies and the many things that we need to care for infectious patients. We know a lot more about the disease at this point. And we've been able to stockpile our supplies a little bit more with a lot of help from the community. So that we will still be ready for a surge while we're also treating people who come into our facilities. We have great screening methods in place for people that enter our facilities, including me. I get screened sometimes two or three times a day as I walk into our facilities. I feel completely safe. I'm there 6-7 days a week as all of our team members are, and I'm not concerned about the public coming in. We just want to continue to stay vigilant. We want to continue to preserve our personal protective equipment in the event there is a surge.
And that's Eric Pinalto, president of Mercy Hospital Northwest Arkansas in Rogers. There is much more to that conversation with Roby Brock, including Pinalto's comments on the communication and coordination among all healthcare systems in Northwest Arkansas during the healthcare crisis. We've got a story and that entire interview online at nwabusinessjournal.com. And finally today, Mother's Day is only a few days away, and despite the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, consumers are expected to spend big on mom this year. The National Retail Federation estimates consumers will spend $26.7 billion celebrating Mother's Day. That's an increase of 7% over the estimate reported a year ago. U.S. retail spending for Mother's Day, according to the NRF, is topped only by Christmas and Valentine's Day. For all the latest headlines, remember you can follow our reporting each and every day at both nwabusinessjournal.com and talkbusiness.net, and also at NWABJ on both Facebook and Twitter. We appreciate you tuning in today for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
Semesters are ending at many colleges and universities this week, and last week we spent a bit of time on Zoom with some University of Arkansas journalism students to learn about a semester-long project they worked on about people living in Northwest Arkansas without permanent shelter. The project was led by Rob Wells, assistant professor of journalism at the U of A, and coordinated through the Howard Center for Investigative Journalism at the University of Maryland. It also included student work from the University of Oregon, Stanford, Boston University, Arizona State, and other campuses. When we met via Zoom last week, the students explained their work that they had been doing for the past several months. We'll hear from Michael Atkinson, Abby Ross, Whitney King, Matthew Moore, and Katie Sider in that order.
I went out personally and interviewed a few homeless people, a couple within the Seven Hills Homeless Center, and then a couple of them just guys who were standing on the street. And one of the first things I asked them was, hey, there was a count for the homeless population in Northwest Arkansas. Were you counted? And every single one of them that I asked said no. And they either just didn't care enough to be a part of it, or they had beliefs against it. There was one man who was outside of the Walmart on MLK, and he was very personally against being considered just a statistic. He said that he deserved more help than just to be counted on a census. And some other people that I asked, they said that it kind of was more like a count of just the homeless centers, not the whole homeless population. But that information is what the U.S. government, specifically HUD, uses to factor in how many homeless people are in the United States at a given time. It's kind of just the sum of the whole, that every continuum of care is what the group is called. That does the count. Every one of those puts in data and they add it all up, and that's the homeless population. And so when there's little discrepancies here or there on the individual scale, the big number is thrown off. And so that was kind of one of the things I touched on, was that it seemed like they were not getting accurate counts as far as what Northwest Arkansas homelessness looked like.
What I focused on this semester and went into the class knowing that I wanted to focus on was college students in Fayetteville and how many of them are homeless. We actually don't have a number for that. And that's one of the things that really shocked me when I started covering this beat, was the fact that, you know, they're there. Like, most of us know someone who's sleeping on a couch or didn't have anywhere to stay because they couldn't pay their rent. They couldn't afford it. But the university doesn't have those numbers, because after your first year of college here, you just apply with an address. It doesn't have to be the address you live with. As long as they have somewhere to send things, it doesn't matter if it's your address or your aunt's or your uncle's or friends. So we have no real way of knowing how many of these students are homeless. And that's one of the things I've really been focusing on. And I've been talking with professors on campus, like Dr. Kevin Fitzpatrick. Mm-hmm. He's really great. And he's actually working on something now to help get a number for that. But we don't know. So it's a lot of like trying to figure out where these students would go and like what resources there are for these students, because it's kind of varied. Like, you can go to the food pantry or you can go to UA Cares and get this $500 grant, but there's like no catch-all. If I was to become homeless today, I wouldn't know the first step of where to go. And that's something I want people to know.
The whole semester I focused on homeless felons. I focused on several aspects of their lives, whether it be finding housing, keeping jobs, applying for housing. So we really focused on all the aspects and all the obstacles that they go through. It was a very unique experience for me, and I was honored to work with all these universities across the United States. I was honored to work with Dr. Wells and the rest of this class. I actually got to collaborate a little bit with Michael when he started working on the jail data. So I'm very thankful that I did do this class this semester.
And when we're talking about homeless felons, people who have a felony on their record, I imagine that just makes the attempt to find permanent shelter that much harder.
Yes. Most of the information I got, they were either couch surfing, basically living with family members sort of under the radar. I did end up speaking to some people that were homeless for over 40 years because of this. So yes, it was a very difficult lifestyle, and just finding somewhere that would even give them a chance was difficult. So, because most people screen for those kind of things.
My first story was a radio story where I discussed veteran homelessness. And in November of 2019, on Veterans Day, the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette did a story talking about how they were planning to hopefully end veteran homelessness by the end of 2019. And I started doing this reporting in early February. And at that point, veteran homelessness had not ended. And I wanted to understand what were the roadblocks, what were keeping people from being able to stop being homeless if they were veterans. And here we sit at the end of April and still have not ended veteran homelessness. And so one of the statistics that really stuck out to me was the things that limit people from being able to access services through the Veterans Affair. And so some of those things include being dishonorably discharged from the military, serving in the National Guard, but never being deployed. And one of the things that happens a lot of times is that veterans blow through their vouchers that they have access to through Veterans Affairs. And part of that is that they will be able to get into housing. And they have been gifted a couch where they've been allowed to sleep on somebody's sofa for a time in the past, and they feel that they ought to reciprocate that to their friends, and that breaks their vouchers, and so they lose out on a voucher through that, and that happens two or three times, and they are out of vouchers from the VA to help credit them housing, and so that is that can be a very interesting bureaucratic nightmare on both sides of the process.
So my first focus was on tent encampments. I wanted to, I think tent encampments is like what most people think of right away when you say homelessness. And so I wanted to look into that and how that's been in the Northwest Arkansas area. So I met two men who have been living in tent encampments on and off over the years and kind of did a profile on them and on tent encampments in general in the area and how the university has kind of had an impact on the encampment locations in Fayetteville. And then moving past the tent encampments, I wanted to look at youth homelessness in school districts. So I looked up some data with every school district in Arkansas, the homeless rates, and Berryville School District actually had a pretty high rate. And so I went down there and met with a lot of people in that school district and kind of got a better understanding of why homelessness is so high there.
We heard from Katie Sider, Matthew Moore, Whitney King, Abby Ross, and Michael Atkinson, journalism students at the University of Arkansas who worked this past semester on a project about people living without permanent shelter in Northwest Arkansas. Much of their work and the work of other students who worked on that project can be seen at razorbackreporter.uark.edu. The class was led by Rob Wells, assistant professor of journalism at the University of Arkansas. So we heard about what they covered on today's show. Tomorrow, we'll learn more about the process of their work. That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7.
That's Dave Brubeck and Jerry Mulligan in the background. And I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday. We'll hear more from Brubeck. We'll also hear from John Coltrane, Stan Getz, Gene Bertoncini, Lawston Harris, and much more. Tune in Fridays and Saturdays here on KUAF for Shades of Jazz.
Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsberg tomorrow night from 10 to midnight on 91.3, Saturday morning beginning at 11 on KUAF3. Just tell your smart speaker, play KUAF3, or tune it in at KUAF.com or on your HD radio. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Scranton, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Antoinette Grajeda and Jacqueline Froelich. Timothy Dennis mastered our show tonight. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling and Roby Brock comes to us through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. More at talkbusiness.net. Our show theme written and performed by Daryl Sean. Okay, we've made it to Thursday night. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon for a brand new Friday edition of Ozarks at Large. Be well. Talk to you soon.